hugely paradoxical and contradictory, apparently, to say the nonviolent violent. But that's the whole point, you see, is that there's this honesty of violence as the key, the core, the crucial human issue. The Bible puts that out there because it's grappling with it. It's not because it's a kind of like a pornography of violence, anything but it's an honesty of violence.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and the Ravencast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we explore mimetic theory and the conflicts and rivalries that so often divide our lives, our nation, and our world. And we hope to come up with some good non-violent solutions to those problems. And I am here today with my dear friend and colleague, Lindsay Paris Lopez at the Raven Foundation. And oh my gosh, I am so excited because we have two surprise guests with us today, Tony and Linda Bartlett. Hi, Tony and Linda. How are you today?
Hi, we're very well. We are just as surprised as you are.
Well, I am doing really well because you are, is it fair to say that you are the co-authors of this book? I don't know. Wait, okay. I don't care what you say about that. I'm going to say you're the co-authors of this book because this book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible, was a product of a community.
Basically, yes.
So this is kind of like Tony did a lot of the grunt work in this, but Linda was just as involved as everyone else in bringing this to fruition.
Yeah, it was like a filter. I mean, like I kind of had this main idea, but then we talked about it and we went through the stories again and again, and to the point where you couldn't really be certain about. Well, I suppose basically you knew it was my ideas, but then a lot of other people's ideas went in there, or expressions and questions and stuff. So it was filtered through the community. And the biggest filter was this person here.
The material kind of came out of, because we've been meeting as a community, having Bible studies for, I don't know, 20 years. And Tony's led most of those studies. So the material is familiar, or most of the material wasn't kind of new to our community, but Tony had the idea of kind of making a Bible study 101, you know, kind of condensing key thoughts.
It's more like 303, really.
Well, you know, because people in our community were saying, this is great, we love coming here, but how do we tell other people about the Bible in this way? How do we even start the conversation? And so as a result of that, Tony did a course. It was over about 7 or 8 weeks, and he called it the Seven Stories, so that it could be like a tool that we community members use to help explain why we're not Christians that use the Bible to bash people over the head, that we actually use it as a liberating, freeing kind of document, stories. And so he ran the course over 7 or 8 weeks, you know, and then one of our community members, Jessamine, said, we've got to write this down. So then the idea for the book came. We ran the course again. Tony had a few of the community members sort of summarize the things that were important to them from the course. So we kind of took turns in running the Bible study, using that as a sort of a frame. And then Jessamine, Tony, and myself met, and we took the stories and started expanding them. And then it became like three stories for each lesson, or three lessons for each story, I should say. And then Tony had his crib notes for the classes, so I wrote them up. And then he took them and then rewrote it all. And then I took what he wrote and edited it down so that the ordinary, everyday, non-theologically literate person might have better understanding of it. And it kind of got edited a couple of times. Tony would edit it to make sure it was biblically acceptable, theologically acceptable for him. And I would edit it to make sure that a regular Joe could understand it. That's
how it came about. Well, thank you for doing that work, Linda. I appreciate it. Yes, that's awesome.
I've been to this case forever to write the Bible, because the Bible studies are much more
live
and accessible, and everyone gets very excited about them. And I said, if we could just capture these in a book, that would be important, you know. So that's kind of how that grew.
Absolutely. I love it. Well, Lindsay, you and I have been doing kind of discussions, Bible study discussions on each chapter of the book. And today we're going to talk about chapter 5, Victim to Vindication, which is another fantastic chapter. But we got this really great surprise, Tony and Linda joining us today. So I thought that we would talk about them, with the process of the book, kind of take a pause and going through chapter by chapter. But Lindsay, I want to bring you in and see if you have any questions for Tony and Linda.
I'm not sure exactly what questions I might have about the methodology and the process. I find the book itself just fascinating and just so clear, so well laid out. You both did a fantastic job. I've always been compelled by your poetical and philosophical insights, Tony, but sometimes they have left me scratching my head and running for dictionaries. And so I can definitely see where your work in making it more accessible, Linda, has come in. And not only more accessible, it's not just that. Our whole understanding of everything comes from each other, comes from community. That's what mimetic theory is all about, that we learn through the models of each other. And so I'm sure that this book could not have come from one isolated mind, because there's no such thing. And it took the whole community working this out together. And that's why I feel like it needs to be read in community. And that's why I like discussing it with my friend Adam. And that's why I hope to have broader discussions, to use it in my own church, to use it in online settings, to just use it eventually with my husband. We've decided to read this together when both of us are a little less busy than we are. So because it really takes a community. And I love it so much. I love the insights I keep having. I love the aha moments. I love going into it pretty much knowing what I was going to get overall, because I know Tony and I know mimetic theory and I know the nonviolent Bible, but I didn't know it this way until now. And just to learn that I can keep learning is wonderful.
Well, I think that when Tony was writing the chapters, a lot of the statements we were trying to simplify it, we were condensing things, ideas or insights into very small, like just a paragraph or whatever, and so it means that you can read the. If you're reading it on your own, you can read the chapter very quickly. I mean, they're only about 4 or 5 pages each. But because it's been refined and refined and refined down to the very, just one paragraph covers a whole depth of research, yeah. That it works well, I think, in terms of groups, because it doesn't take a lot for, if you've got 2 or 3 people in a group, to start unpacking each of those paragraphs, and so that it lends itself to discussion. I think it lends itself to group work, because there's so much packed in there. In fact, when we teach it, one lesson over 2 hours. We're always getting sidetracked. We're going off in different tangents, and it's very rare that we actually get to cover all the material because you know, there's just so many different directions you can go with the material.
Right.
It's a whole Bible all in one. You can't really do the Bible justice in that size book, so it's understandable. But I think it does lend itself to the community setting.
Yeah. Well, Adam and I have been trying to go through all three lessons of each story in just over half an hour. And that, so that's really, really.
We do it. Yeah, we do it in like 45 minutes. So it's good. Try to keep the half an hour. No, 45 minutes. I want to ask you about the title of the book, because even just the title of the book is kind of, I don't know, it's making a statement, right? So the subtitle is How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible. And Linda, this goes back to one of your comments that you made earlier that, like, you know, we're going to try to interpret the Bible in a way that doesn't, like, bat people over the head with it. But there's, like, I'm sure that a lot of people, when they see the term nonviolent Bible put together, they'd be like, what are you talking about? So how did you come up with this subtitle, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think about titles a lot because, obviously, it's the tag. It's the thing that's going to get people's attention right at the beginning or not. Mm-hmm. But the seven stories was those two words was, they were obviously dictated by the structure of the thing, and the structure is very important because it takes you through the arc of the Bible, the whole Bible's narrative. It makes a challenge to the reader and to anybody who's interpreting, say, well, yeah, you can understand the Bible via these seven stories. So that's already a huge structural kind of claim. You're saying this is the way the Bible works. But then the subtitle, which is more explanatory, and people go to that and they will look at that and say, well, you know, how is this setting? What is the content? How can you unpack that a little bit for us? And I decided that it was How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible because precisely everybody assumes that the Bible is horrendously violent, mm-hmm. which on one level, of course, it is. There's all sorts of slaughters and battles, and mm-hmm. there's the crucifixion itself in the gospel and the Christian Bible, which is horribly violent, and you that ends up with Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, which it actually, you know, puts that, splashes it on screen because it's a possibility of the narrative, the violence of that death. So, you know, it's hugely paradoxical and contradictory, apparently, to say the nonviolent Bible. But that's the whole point, you see, is that the Bible puts that out there because it's grappling with it. It's not because it's a kind of like a pornography of violence, anything but it's an honesty of violence. It's a truthfulness of violence, which is what René Girard has done, you know, the amazing thinker who has gathered Raven and all of us together around what is called mimetic theory. There's this honesty of violence as the key, the core, the crucial human issue. So it's like therapy, you know, like you sit down and say, well, tell me about the arguments you've had. It's not in order to repeat those arguments and get all upset again and argue over and over of those points. It's to get to the root of the problem. And that's why we call it the How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible, because that's the root narrative. Mm-hmm. That is the core coding, should we say, mm-hmm. Of the Bible is nonviolence. And it's a surprising, but it's true. And this is a truth, of course, that we need to shout from the rooftops, and that's what Raven is doing.
Give us an example of how the Bible is doing this, because so many people point to, oh, the violent aspect of it. Where do you see the truth of the nonviolence coming through in the Bible? One important story?
Well, the story that resonates most powerfully for me. In what we call the Old Testament, of course, when you get to Jesus, he explicitly teaches to love your enemy. But in the Old Testament, you get this amazing story of this scoundrel Jacob, who has stolen his brother's birthright and stolen the blessing, which is a big deal because they didn't have cars and TVs in those days or houses. I mean, they had tents and stuff. So the major thing a dad could give his son was this verbal declaration of what he's going to be about. And even today, when you think about fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, or anybody, you know, is that the things that they say to us at certain key points, you know, carry us through, you know, carry us on. And so that blessing is hugely important. And Jacob stole it. He just stole that thing of measurable value, you know. And then his mum says, get out of here. Beat it before Esau kills you. And so then he goes off and spends 14 years basically tricking his way to immense fortunes. I mean, he reminds us of, I mean, basically Jacob is a Ponzi scheme, you know, like he's a trickster. And then he has to come back. It's time for him to return. He wants to return, and he's got all these wives and children and stuff. And he knows he has to, this is the reckoning. What's he going to do? So anyway, I mean, to cut the long story short, he has this encounter with God, and it's a beautiful encounter, and it's very mysterious. He sees the face of God, which he totally doesn't deserve. And then Esau, who's coming to meet him with 400 guys, remember, he's got 400 men, armed men. They're definitely armed. Mm-hmm. And they're probably up on some kind of war horse or camel or something. I mean, it's going to be scary. And all he's got is women and children and some servants and flocks. And this guy could massacre him and take his stuff. But what happens is that, you know, in the whole arc of the Bible, if you bring the Gospels in, Esau acts just like the father in the story of the prodigal son. I mean, if you kind of do a movie, kind of leap forward in time or something, you know, and bring that scene in and see the father coming to meet this trickster and this no good Jacob, running to meet him, embracing him, weeping, and totally forgiving him. And it's an explosive scene of forgiveness. And we bypass, and it has been bypassed in the tradition, in the way in which we've understood that stuff, because that's the kind of weird way they behave in the desert. It's kind of like strange behavior. No, it's there right in the middle of Genesis to contradict the violence and to resolve the violence. I mean, like Genesis actually resolves the whole issue of chapters 1 to 11, where you've got the rivalry with God, you've got the murder of Abel by Cain, and the violence of the flood. It resolves that. It resolves it all together by ending up with this magnificent scene of peace and plenty and harmony in Egypt. It's the whole story of creation in one. So there you are, that's it. And it revolves around the face of God as forgiveness and nonviolence. I mean, it's totally there.
I love it. And it brings me back to what you were saying about Gerard and how he helps us deal with our violence and how the Bible helps us deal with our violence, because Jacob is the archetypal figure of Israel. Like, if you're going to make up a story about your, like, patriarch, the patriarch, the one who becomes Israel, you're not going to tell it as, oh, our guy was a total fraud, right? You're going to want to tell it as, oh, look at how great our ancestors were. But the Bible is just, as you said, so honest about who we are. And this, we are much more like Jacob than we are like Enoch, right? Who walks with God and goes up to the heavens and yay, Enoch. No, we're like Jacob.
I also love that story, and reading it again as you presented it just brought so many ideas to me. The story of Jacob crossing the Jabbok, and just that part of it was part of my confirmation story, as I said before. That was the text that we used on the first day that we began the process of confirmation. And I just remember crossing a little trickle of a river, and that was to symbolize the beginning of a journey. And throughout my life, I've thought about struggling in the Jabbok with God, and I've wrestled with God and with my ideas of God, my whole life. But reading this story and remembering the larger context that Jacob struggles in the river just before he goes out and meets his brother, the brother he's cheated and deceived and lied to and is probably expecting to be killed by. I actually had the thought when I studied this that the Bible, and I don't read Greek or Hebrew, much less, so I don't know what the actual words say, but the translation has it with as he wrestled with a man. It doesn't say God, it says man, and then it says the man gives him a new name, but he asks, what's your name? And the guy said, why do you want to know that? And just disappears. And it actually occurred to me, what if it's actually Esau that he's wrestling in the Jabbok? Like, it's so ambiguous, you know, that they're about to meet each other. What if he just can't see his brother? And his brother wrestles out all the issues that he has and then gives him a blessing. Like, I mean, Jacob stole the blessing. What blessing does Esau have to give? Yet Esau has come to a place of forgiveness and reconciliation and love for Jacob so that when they meet and they embrace, Esau doesn't want any compensation for the way he's been wronged. And Jacob says, seeing you is like seeing the face of God. And it made me think, what if that was Esau in the river with him and God? I mean, I don't know, but it was just an idea that occurred to me.
That really is very, very important, Lindsay, for the way in which we understand the Bible. As Christians in the 21st century, basically, is because the Bible is always telling those two stories together. It's telling the story of humans, mm-hmm. and it's telling the story of God. They're both intimately interlinked. So when he sees the man, yes, he is struggling with the man. Then he understands, and it's Esau, because Esau does behave exactly as you say. Mm-hmm. Esau does behave like that. Esau, you know, has no resentment and no anger, you know, and no will to kill. But that's the story of God too. We cannot understand God because as Gerard tells us, we're structured out of violence to begin with, which is the terrible kind of struggle human beings have, that our ancestry and our DNA is kind of like against us, and we so quickly revert to it. But there's also compassion to human possibility. And then when we begin to exercise, when the stories tell us that, we begin to say, ah, that's the nature of God. Mm-hmm. It's the Bible is this huge mm-hmm. machine of translation. It's a tool to translate for us who and what God is.
And the more you do it, the more you begin to read the Bible in that light, the more you see it everywhere in all the other passages yes. that you haven't studied, you yeah. start to see the nonviolence of God coming through in all of the different passages, you know, that you see it more as revelatory in terms of either ourselves, or you can say, well, this is the Bible describing how humans interact, how humans are, you know, the violence that are, and then when you see God's action or the revelation of the nonviolent God, it really speaks, and it sort of stands out in the page, and you the more you do it, the more you can see it until it, you know, you almost, well, it just becomes easier as you go on.
Yeah. One of the other things that I love about that story is that Esau is seen as the ancestor of Edom, which is one of Israel's enemies. Right. And so here we have Israel, like the people telling the story, oh, our ancestor was this Jacob guy who was this fraud. And we received this incredible forgiveness from our enemies.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So Jesus is picking up this like forgiveness of enemies from his stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's one of the things that I love about your book is that as Christians, we can often get into, oh, Old Testament bad, Jesus good. But you don't allow us to do that. And I find that so refreshing.
Yep. I mean, the whole thing of literary analysis, literary critique. I mean, that's what Gerard started with. He started with Deceit, Desire, and the Novel, looking at these great books and writings in Shakespeare. And he begins to see this other narrative in all of them, you know, and it's a matter of what he calls conversion. You've got at some point the author gets converted, and he realizes that he or she has a problem, and then that writing becomes. So really, Jesus was the original critic, the literary critic that saw what was going on in these texts. I mean, it doesn't take much, but then it takes a lot.
You know? Editing as he was going on.
He was very selective. Yeah, he was.
In the book, we give that example of when he opens the scriptures when he's preaching in Nazareth, right?
Yeah.
And he opens the scroll and he's quoting Isaiah. But then he chooses to leave off the final line of that passage from Isaiah, where it says, "The judgment of God."
Proclaim the Lord's year of favor and of revenge.
He leaves out the words "and revenge."
Yeah.
So Jesus was editing his own scriptures, his own tradition, also. So he was.
Linda, I am so glad that you brought that up, because it was one of my aha moments. Here in chapter 5, that we were doing From Victim to Vindication, because Tony, you guys bring this up in, I think it's Jonah. I have it here. Jonah is quoting from, I think it's Exodus, and he leaves out the harsher language of Exodus 34. 7b, right? And so the accent is purely on the Lord's mercy. So this in Exodus, I think it says this: that is why God is merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. But Exodus says punishing from generation to generation. And Jonah's like, we're just not going to quote that part of it. We're going to leave that part out. Right. And this is the exact same thing that Jesus does. And so Jesus isn't making this up like out of nowhere. He's fully within his Jewish tradition, in the Jonah tradition.
But what's interesting about Jonah is that when he quotes that to God about how merciful God is, he's not doing it in adoration and worship. He's doing it like, this is why I ran away, because you're too nice, God. You're way too nice. You're not going to kill them like they deserve. And I mean, no sense of irony that he ran away from God, and for that, most people would think that he deserves death. And he's spared from death himself.
It's another example of how like these ancient Jews told their stories. One of our greatest prophets, Jonah, ran away from God. These are not ideal figures. It's just fantastic.
Completely pissed off with God.
Yes. Said,
throw me in the sea. I don't care. You know, I'd rather be dead than have to deal with this.
Right.
And Jesus says, you know, the only sign you're going to be given is the sign of Jonah.
Right.
And he identifies with Jonah. So.
That's awesome.
I love that. I love your treatment of Jonah. And I first encountered it, by the way, in Virtually Christian. So this was not. I enjoyed reading it here, but the first time I saw it was in Virtually Christian. I was like, wow, I love that. I remember debating the book of Jonah with my Muslim friends. And to be completely fair to them, Matthew does the story of Jonah a great disservice when it tries to interpret Jesus's words about the sign of Jonah as the amount of time that that Jesus will spend, you know, buried in the ground and dead. There's actually a Muslim who has made it his job to dispute the Bible, who says, how many days was Jesus in the ground? How many days was Jonah in the whale? This makes no sense. You count 1, 2, 3 days and nights for Jonah. You count a night, a day, and a tiny bit of mourning for Jesus, and it doesn't work out the same way. It's not the amount of time. It's the whole story. It's the whole story of forgiveness without the shedding of blood, forgiveness without destruction, forgiveness without vengeance. It's the whole idea that the same God that everyone's afraid of on the boat, and the same God that ultimately calms the storm when Jonah is thrown into the sea, is not actually a God who requires vengeance. So the story itself kind of works through God. You know, the God at the beginning is kind of scary, but it turns out that that's just our perception of God, because God is actually too merciful even for us to really grasp and handle and appreciate.
What you just said there, Lindsay, is also another hugely important point in the overall study of the New Testament, because you just said basically Matthew did not understand the tradition about the only sign that will be given you is the sign of Jonah. He put in basically an interpretation that suited him and that would make sense in the early church, but he preserved a saying which we then unpack because of all other mentions of Jonah, and because also of what Jesus actually does going to Jerusalem. So it shows what Gerard calls an intelligence in the text, an intelligence which takes time to unpack, because we're so stupid, because we're so slow to get it, you know,
including
first disciples. So the intelligence is basically the intelligence of Jesus. You know, it's his mind that has seen this. And when he says, I'll give you the sign, the only sign you'll get is the sign of Jonah, he just leaves it like that. He doesn't go on, he doesn't write a book about it, he doesn't go on and on. Basically, because he's leaving us this information that we need to unpack, and that it will take time to unpack, because it has to come in terms of... You can't understand the sign of Jonah without that conversion that happened, that the book of Jonah is actually trying to bring about, and that Jesus, of course, was seeking as well. That it's a retelling of the human story at a fundamental level.
Mm-hmm.
It's the human story, and if you start telling children a new story, they'll understand it in the ways in which they always understand stories. How do we tell a new story? And it just takes an enormous amount of time and retelling and circumstances and doing exactly what we're doing now. You know, it's so wonderful.
I like Jonah because it's like a little synopsis of the whole process, because you start off with a story that they're looking. The storm swells up, and so the human thing is, you look for a scapegoat. Someone has to be causing this, and so they're searching around, and so Jonah becomes a scapegoat. He kind of offers himself as a scapegoat, and then God doesn't even allow, because the sea, that storm tempest sea, is also the sort of a representation of the kind of chaotic violence, and God uses a sea monster. Well, they would have understood a whale as a sea monster to actually save Jonah. Like you're saying, he didn't deserve to be saved. So God is always, is beginning even there to reveal his nature, his or her nature, you know, and then you get the saving of the worst possible, you know, the people who are, the, you know, considered like the most immoral people, but they are worth, so everyone is worth saving, and God is trying to teach Jonah, you know, through the shade of the tree, you know, that the worm, you know, he's trying to teach him. It was so hard to teach, you know, about that.
I mean, the idea that Jonah was responsible for the storm because it was God's punishment. That's the whole Deuteronomic worldview, that if you just stop there, that would affirm, it would affirm it. But as you go on, it's contradicted by the fact that God does save Jonah. And the idea that Jonah deserves to die because of what he has done is our human idea, that this whole story is saying, no, he made a mistake, and there are consequences, but he doesn't deserve to die. He deserves redemption, because God, that's what God gives us over and over, because God doesn't cut us off when we make mistakes. And the story just shows that. And I love how you say that the whole thing is an encapsulation, not only of the gospel, but of the human learning process, and how thick we are and how slow we are to get it. I mean, it's the gospel, but it's also, it explains not only the gospel, but why we still misunderstand the gospel, because it acknowledges our, I'll say, sinfulness. People might have a problem with that word, but it acknowledges the ways that we are still broken and incomplete and unable to fully understand God. And it acknowledges how mean we can be to other people who are also broken and incomplete, even when we recognize it within ourselves. I mean, it gives the whole human struggle as well as God's forgiveness. So it's an amazing, amazing story. Tony and Linda, I love the way you handle Job too, at the beginning of this lesson. I think for all of these stories, there's a sense of, if you try to read it just on a surface level, you'll never really get it. And it takes the same images that we have used to understand and justify and proclaim a violent God. It takes those same images and subverts them. But because it's the same images, and because that's the only way we can learn, is to use the same story and slowly change the meaning. You know, we can miss it. In the story of Jonah, you talk about how the whole thing hinges on what's often even mistranslated in the Bible. And I found that kind of fascinating. Job, after all of his friends say, you must have done something wrong. And Job keeps proclaiming his innocence and finally cries out to God. And God says, well, who are you? I'm really great and you're nobody. And then the text says that Job repents and despises himself. But you say that that's not what the text actually says. And that really just changes everything. Can you tell us more about that? I could go on, but I'll let you do it, because...
Well, I've never studied Hebrew, and it's one area of my, well, I'm Augustine never studied Hebrew either. He didn't even know Greek. I don't know Greek, so that's okay. But thank God for interlinear text online. I mean, you can learn a lot from that. And I sat through a whole semester of a class on Job by a Jesuit called Ben Braley, back in Heathrow College, God knows when, way back. And they call him Rabbi Ben Braley because he dressed in a kind of Old Testament way. This was the 70s, early 70s. He had very long black hair. He was very big guy, very imposing. Never talked to anybody except the most brilliant guy in the class.
Which was you, Tony. You had a lot of good conversations with him, right?
No, never. Yes. Never It was a Jesuit. It was a young Jesuit. But anyway, I learned nothing from that class. This guy knew in and out, and he would quote all. But it was just so much detail and so much, like in Job, it has the greatest number of one-time use only Hebrew words in the Bible is in Job.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, you can't. There's so many words in there that they're only used in Job. It's just magnificent. Like Shakespeare, a magnificent work of poetry. I was just baffled by that course. But I felt I had a spiritual duty to persevere with it when most people gave up. But I just sat through it. It was like a it was like a retreat, you know, when you knew nothing, rather than. So then afterwards, I think God rewarded, or you know, rewarded that patience by doing basically showing the, well, Gerard, first of all, saying that this is an act, this is a text about group victimage. The three so-called friends are basically the mob, and they're blaming him in the most polite way, but they want to see him go down, and he's already down, but they just want him to acknowledge it, like a good victim would do. And then, of course, Gerard brings forth all the images of animals and beasts and savage animals. When God is talking, that God kind of like assembles this battery of violence against, in some of the imagery. And then when at the end, he basically says, you know, I can control violence. Can you control Leviathan? If you know, are you able to do that? No, you can't. So shut up, you know? And so then Gerard makes a tremendous amount of sense of the dynamic. And he said, and then you see that this is a completely alternative version to, what the Deuteronomic worldview is saying, that you know, if you sin, then you will be punished. If you do good, you will be rewarded. And Job is saying, no, that's not the case. That's not how it works out. Sometimes really bad stuff happens to us, and we're not at all responsible, mm-hmm. and certainly not responsible at the level where all this really horrendous stuff. I mean, you know, like only you're going to think about the horrors of the 20th century. The dropping of the bomb, the nuclear bomb. You know, are you going to say all the people of Hiroshima were responsible for what happened? You know, no. Everybody knows now that doesn't make sense. But Job was reversing that and asking God, saying, "Ask God, please explain this." Mm-hmm. And there is no explanation, except Job himself becomes an explanation. God says, right at the end, he says to the friends, so-called friends, go and ask Job to pray for you. Otherwise, my wrath will be unleashed against you guys, and Job will help you. So Job going through that experience and asking those deep human questions and challenging the whole structure of scapegoating and punishment, he becomes the way in which that fundamental question is answered. But it's one stage along the way. But it's a hugely revelatory piece. And then of course there's that bit which you quoted, Lindsay, about I repent what I said in dust and ashes. He says, I regret and reject dust and ashes. These words have that, and it's not reflexive. I don't repent. That is, I don't regret myself. I just regret those dust and ashes. I regret that crap, excuse me, in which I don't like it. I don't like that whole situation, and I reject it. And that's much more dynamic a conclusion to the book than saying, well, like, you know, we in our Bible study groups, you know, you always learn something, but we have ex-fundamentalists sometimes, and they said that Job was a righteous man, but what he did wrong was hanging on to his own righteousness. I mean, like, he didn't do any wrong morally, all that stuff, but what he did wrong was saying, I am righteous, but I also should say nevertheless I'm a sinner. Now that's the classic, that you're a sinner, come away. No, Job is a human being, and the question is not external righteousness. The question is the dynamic of violence that's going on, and how we interpret things through that, and understand our world through it. And God in the Bible is trying to change the narrative, trying to change the fundamental story. Job is a huge example of someone. He's a hero of retranslating the human condition.
Yes. Yes. And there's so much pressure on the victim to accept blame. There's so much pressure on victims to accept blame. I mean, and we see this today. We see this with people who are the victims of abuse, the way that the way that they're gaslighted and told to just, you know, told that it's your fault when bad things happen to them. And Job's refusal to do that can be a model for anyone who is suffering arbitrarily. And I mean, this story is very interesting because it's so clearly a wrestling with the understanding of God, because God is a complete jerk in this story.
Yes, he has this kind of gambling match with Satan.
Right, right.
Bored. God is bored in heaven, and his official kind of prosecutor comes in. He says, "Yeah, how about we kind of torment this guy and then see who comes out best?" You know, that's not a worthy picture of God, and it's given deliberately to make us question our picture of God.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's awesome.
One of the things that I love about the friends is that right in the beginning, they come to Job and they just sit with him in silence.
I know.
Right? So this is the ancient Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva. So you sit in silence for 7 days, right, and you only talk when the other person like talks. You don't try to come up with answers or anything. And so what I think the book of Job is saying is like, when you try to come up with answers for why people are suffering, you're going to start blaming, and don't do that. Yeah, just right. Like God should shut up. You should shut up too.
Amen.
So we talked about Job and we talked about Jonah, and in between you have a section on the Goel or the Redeemer. Could you explain that concept for us, please?
Yeah, well, that is a slightly technical notion, but it's very important because, as in so many things, our words have deep roots, and they have ambiguous roots, or they belong originally to generative violence, and then the Bible is teasing out this new meaning of generative forgiveness and compassion. And the Goel I remember when I first heard someone explaining the notion of the Goel, it was basically a liberation theologian from Latin America. And I was so astonished that something which had this airy-fairy meaning, redemption, you know, it was basically, I got this soul, immortal soul, it's going to live forever. And, you know, if I don't take care of that, it could have one horrendous life expectancy of forever, but torment. So and redemption is the price that's paid that I can get to heaven. You know, I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's universal across Protestantism and Catholicism in terms of the deal that's made by God through Jesus to get it, to make us okay. And when this man explained that redemption was something much more earthy and real and human and belonged to the original levels of the condition of human beings reacting directly to violence and to the experience of violence and how they dealt with it. It was such an inflooding of light that the Bible is dealing with actual human life and the things that counts so much in human life, most of all. It's not dealing with this kind of scary afterlife. It's dealing with scary this life, you know, which is what we need to be scared about. So that was such a breakthrough. And I understood that the Goel is essentially, and this is the technical nature of the word, is your nearest relative who has to go and restore your alienated life. And that is normally if someone's killed you and your blood is lying on the ground, is this kind of semi-magical but real sense of blood mm-hmm. crying out, you know, that you cannot go round shedding people's blood and just forget about it. Mm-hmm. You have to restore it somehow. And so the most primitive but real way of restoring it is going killing the person who killed you, eye for an eye kind of thing. And the rules in the Old Testament are trying to limit that so it doesn't become an endless vendetta. They understand the reciprocity of violence and killing, then that has to be resolved somehow. But you want to limit that so it doesn't become the kind of like the an endless vendetta. So the Goel is this redeemer who has this function. But then by the time you get to Jesus, and I am cutting a long story short here in terms of all the examples of it, he completely turns that over. He restores our life, mm-hmm. our alienated life. And that can happen in many ways. Our lives can be taken away from us. It could be killing, but it could be oppression of any sort. It could be humiliation. It could be sickness. It could be disease, etc. Jesus restores that through compassion and love, mm-hmm. yeah. and by giving himself into that situation. So he's taken that word of revenge with a real human meaning mm-hmm. of restoration. The only way we knew how to restore is through revenge. And that's still standard. You know, I need to get my kind of selfhood back by having revenge on this person, by shooting the person who shot my brother or whatever, you know. But Jesus gives us another way of restoration. What you're saying, restoration is essential. You can't be a human being without recognizing and adhering to that rule of life that if life is taken away, it needs to be restored. Mm-hmm. You can't just ignore it. Mm-hmm. But he gives us this other way of, so it makes so much sense. And it is the gospel. It's the gospel of restoration, of redemption, you know, like, and it gives meaning to that horribly abstract word.
I loved the way you presented it, because I could really see the connection between vengeance and mercy, and how in the end both of them are linked to what humans need to feel our lives renewed. I mean, vengeance is a false renewal of our lives, but it feels so right in the moment to get even, to take back what someone has taken for you, and to transition from that, from the version of Goel in Exodus where it gives all the laws and the conditions under which you may or may not kill someone who has killed someone important to you. All of that, you take us through that, and that makes a lot of sense on a human level, that need for vengeance. And you take us through the story of Ruth, who restores the life of Naomi through her faithfulness and her choice to remain and be there by her side. And that's another way to restore life. Boaz comes in as the official Goel, but it's Ruth who makes the choice to remain in love with someone she cares about. And it's through her that Naomi's line prospers. And I mean, that's important in a, you know, in a social and cultural and political sense, but it's also just important in a very human sense. She gets to have grandchildren. She gets to, you know, she gets to experience those joys because Naomi remains faithful to her. And the whole concept of Redeemer going from vengeance seeker to someone who loves us and will give themselves for us in the most loving way, you transition through that beautifully, and they both come together so well in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome. What I love about it is that it all makes sense.
It does. You present it so clearly. You guys work together so well to present such a beautiful learning process for us. It takes us through the logic of Scripture and the semiotic shifts. Very, very smoothly.
Yes, this has been such a great treat to have this conversation with you, Linda and Tony. Thank you so much for being here. And we've loved the book, as everybody can tell. So go get the book, put a review of it on Amazon and wherever you find it, because that'll help get the message out. And hey, share this episode with your friends. Get the word out. So thank you both for being here.
Great job, and thank you, Raven.
You bet. And you can join Lindsay and me next week as we continue our discussion of Linda and Tony's book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible. We've talked a lot about the story that we were going to discuss today, which was Victim to Vindication. So we may talk about it again next week, or we may go to the next chapter. What is the next chapter?
Temple.
Oh, yes, the temple. Oh, the temple and its deconstruction. Oh, that'll be so much fun. So, we'll be prepared to talk about either one next week, Monday morning at 10 o'clock Central. So until then, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.